Move the microphone. So, Fairy, if you could think back to your early memories of the Garden History Society, can you remember your first exposure, how you were introduced to the idea of the Garden History Society?
Yes, I was just minding my own business here one day. In the middle of the day, and the phone rang, and it was Pat Cameron from Mona Vale, and she said, "We're having a meeting here," and Judy Lewis, who lives in Hobart, suggested we should have a representative on the Northwest Coast, and she suggested I ring you. So I'm ringing you here and now to say we're having another meeting in a month. Would you give it some consideration and come down to a meeting and see what you think, of us, and you might be interested in joining? So that's what I did. I went down the next month to a meeting, and I was on the committee before you could say no, because, as you know, all committees always looking for new members. So that's how I joined. And Pat Cameron was, of course, the chairman then of the Garden History in Tasmania. And I was one of her staff. And I enjoyed my time with her very much. She was a very good chairman.
Do you recall when this was?
Well, I just looked it up, and I think it was 84, according to my recollections. Winter of 84.
And the meeting was at Mona Vale?
Yes. Pat always had the meetings at Mona Vale. She was a most hospitable person at any time, and we had them in the dining room there in great luxury. And we always had lunch. We all started at 10 o'clock, and we had lunch there, and we finished about 4 with a bit of luck, sometimes a bit later. And if there was anything pressing, because I came the furthest, I'd sometimes stay the night, and one or two others might have too if we had a weekend activity or something like that. And I got to know Pat well, and admire her organising capabilities and her charm and all those sort of things. She really, I was her devoted slave, in other words.
Can you tell me what it was that you were trying to do? What was the society setting up to do?
Well, as I understand it, the people like Howard Tanner and Peter Watts and architects who were interested in the historical side of Tasmania came over from time to time and were guests in these various lovely old homes, and decided that they should be documented, and in their travels around visiting various homes and gardens and things that they were actually doing houses in those days, they discussed amongst each other the benefit of having a garden history as well. Now, I'm not too sure if the garden history was already established on the mainland. I suspect it was, but Tasmania, being a very small state, had quite a lot of almost not instant, but very close together. And I think we got away really to quite a racing start, because we did have quite a lot of historical gardens and homes to draw off.
And had the society been operating for a while before you joined, do you think?
Yes, it had. In the early days, I understand, they'd had one conference here, and they had it in Hobart, and I don't know how many they had. It just might be in my archival. I'll have a look for that. They had it in Hobart, and then they came up to Launceston and had 3 days up there. Now, they had a marvellous time. I don't know how many, but it was their first experience, and everyone opened their larders and their drink cellars, and they went to some of the gardens up north, and they had a thoroughly nice time at anyhow, and it was a great success. That was the very first one in Tasmania.
Were you at that?
No, I wasn't. In fact, I'd never heard of them then. So that must have been about, say, 80. If I joined in 84, probably about 80, 81.
Who else do you think was on the committee at the time that you recollect? Any outstanding people or characters?
On the committee when I joined? Yes, there was Rod Thurkell Johnson, and there was Jeffrey, the museum.
Stillwell? No.
Beginning with it. still will. Jeffrey Stillwell was a member. Zoe Mackay was a member. Margie Stackhouse. Jenny Prevost. Anne Cripps was on very early before I got there, and then she left for some reason, probably your family reasons, and came back later. Of course, in the form of a secretary, very, very efficient. Who else? Oh, I'm talking about the Tasmanian Committee. Ruth Amos from the East Coast. She was a mine of information, marvellous woman.
Do you think most of the emphasis was about providing information and help and knowledge to people that already had historic gardens? Was it really drawing on members from people in that experience, or do you think it was broadening the interest in garden history?
I think it was, as I saw it, completely new thing, and I think it even the owners of these historical, because the historical house and the historical garden sort of went together. Where you had a lovely old house, you generally had a lovely old garden too. And I think it alerted members to, or their friends perhaps, to what they had and how really valuable it could be for themselves and for the history of Tasmania generally. I think it was a sort of wake-up call, that beginnings of that society, and people went away thinking, yes, such and such, that would be an interesting garden, that's an old place. And I think it, for the owners, it was just the first little inkling of there might be some appreciation and some help, perhaps. Help in the way the garden history brought in speakers, and a lot of them amongst their own members were very talented landscapers or historians and things like that. And they, I think they saw light at the end of the long tunnel, that they might get some advice they were looking for, I think, advice. And as the society grew, I noticed advice really was there, and we just didn't know where to look for it. And people like, and this is in the latter years actually, how the tree surgeons have taken a big part in the restoration of these gardens, because the early plantings were very, do I use the word boring, because, you know, 100 years ago we couldn't get all the lovely trees and shrubs we can get today. So they planted pines by the million, still do, but too close to the house, and made the houses very, and the gardens very sombre and shady and overclass, and they weren't really lovely conifers, this is my opinion. And so when the tree surgeons came in about, say, 20 years ago, or might have been earlier, but to my knowledge 20 years ago, they were able to prune these trees with great skill, so that we kept the historical trees, but in better shape. So we didn't destroy them, which is very easy to do, and it was very tempting to do, actually, because I've heard many of these owners say, oh, that wretched tree, you know, every time it blows, a bough falls on the roof and shatters the tiles, and I can't see out the dining room window, and I wish I could cut the tree down. And someone says, oh, no, it's 100 years old, don't cut it down. So they're in a no-win situation. But when the tree surgeons came in, I think they've done an enormous lot. Must say they're costly, but they really, I think they're fantastic what they've done to, particularly those old piney-type trees, early conifers, because they're really quite ordinary.
Getting back to the committee, what stage did Pat retire and then you become the president?
Well, now you've asked me. I'm guessing, but I could, actually should have looked that up. I was the president for 10 years, so I would say 84, 85, 86, probably 87, 87, 88. And we had a meeting at Mona Vale, and Pat had said earlier that she was going to vacate the chair, and I don't blame her two hoots, because in those days we did everything with longhand, and she did an awful lot of writing, and we all wrote in longhand, and you know, with copies here and copies there, and not everyone can read each other's writing. And you know, the headquarters was then in Barrel, where Tim North ran the office, and we had copious instructions from him, and it was a big job, and Pat did it very well. And went.
So who was the secretary at that time?
Tim North was the secretary, and he lived in Bowral, and he was probably the instigator for the Australian Garden History, I imagine.
So you didn't have a state secretary?
Yes, we had a state one, and when I joined, it was Zoe Mackay from Stables, yes, Richmond. Campania, yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Cambridge,
yes. Zoe was the secretary, and then we had
So Pat resigned, and you were the lucky chap.
And we had a weekend at Manor Vale. At least we had a thing on Sunday where we showed films and stuff, and on Saturday we had a plant stall, and I was out at the plant stall, and Zoe came out and said, Pat wants you in the dining room. I said, well, I'll leave the plant store. And she said, yes. And she came in. She said, you're the new chairman. I said, I couldn't possibly be. And she said, a unanimous vote. I think I'm making that up, but a vote at any rate. So I really felt sorry for Pat because she'd done such a, and no one else was willing. So, of course, the Muggins got the job. In the articles, it says that the president shall have a tenure of 3 years and then be re-elected. But after 9 years, she must go, you know, to give someone else a chance. And, of course, as everybody knows, it's not any of those positions are not what you call highly sought after. So I stayed one more year while I, being the president, had to find my next someone who I could con into doing it, which I did. It took me a whole year, and that's why I was there for 10 years, not nine.
Did you enjoy it, Ferry?
Yes, I did. And like everything else, you get the hang of it after a while. The first year is a very learning sort of process. I did, and as I went on, a lot of travelling and a lot of personal contacts, and because I went to boarding school in Launceston, a lot of them were not only personal friends, but friends, and Tasmania is a small place, and yes, and you get better and better at it, you know, and you get hone your skills a bit, and you think, oh yes, I can do this, and they can do that, or we'll do this and we'll do that. You do, you get better and better, and as you get more familiar with it and skilled at it, you enjoy it more. And then it was at the time when we're having terrible strife keeping afloat, and the National Committees asked Tasmania if they could do a garden tour, and it was, I think, the first garden tour we'd ever done. And of course, Muggins again said she thought she could do it. And when I see how sophisticated the garden tours have got today, anyhow, I still think it's probably the best one we ever had, because we had such fun on it, and nobody minded, and everyone rallied round, and, did their very best. And I still get letters from people saying, when are you going to do another tour? Because that one you did 12 years ago was the best one we've ever been on, you know, because it was... Tasmania's easy to do a tour because it's small and it's intimate and everybody knows everyone, and easy to do.
So was it 1991, the tour?
Well, I think so. Yeah. I honestly can't remember. It's a question of looking it up too. Sorry, I should have made a note of that.
So why was the society in such desperate states?
Oh, very complicated. Tim North... had a journal that he published out of Bowral called the Australian Gardener, which I've just looked it up a minute ago. And he said he would give us so many pages for the notes from the garden history to promote it and to to give it a bit of a start, because we had no money, and although we all paid subs and things, we paid Tim to do this, and he had shares in this rather complicated business it was. He had shares in this garden magazine, and that was his living, and he gave us 2 pages, which after a while we didn't think was enough, and like everything else, we asked for a bit more, and a few more pages and a bit more writing about promoting us, and he said we'd have to pay for it more or less, and we said we haven't got any money, and so it went on. He said, well, I'm finding now that the garden history isn't strong enough to bring in extra readers for myself, and he said, you're not advertising, you're sort of using me, so it's delicately and diplomatically done. But we came to the parting of the ways, and then we decided we would pay a girl, she was also in Barrel, Diana Forrester, and she was a economics or business, she had a business degree in economics, and she was very highly qualified, too highly qualified for us. And she did feasibility studies and all sorts of things like this, and told us where we were going wrong, which we, you know, was fairly obvious, but wasn't bringing any money in. And we really had to get some money by hook or by crook. And Michael Blythe was the treasurer, who is a delightful person, and he's a landscape gardener from Goulburn, and he was the treasurer, and we got into great strife financially. We just couldn't pay away, and we were all called upon to rally round and see what we could do, but we got out of it, and that was when Robin Lawarn took over the National Treasury, and she really got stuck into us all and said, you know, you're not businesslike. This is what, she was an accountant, thank God, and this is what you've got to do, and this is what I want from you, and these are the statements, and I need the statements clearly indicating what you've spent, what you haven't spent, and where you're getting your money from. And she put us really on the right track, and I don't know how many years she was there for, but she, I'd say 7. Marvellous woman, absolutely marvellous. And when you went to the conferences and the AGMs, Robin had all the answers and all the figures, and it was just absolute bliss. And we all knew what we had to do. And now we have Elizabeth Walker, who looks after us just as well. But Robin was the one who dragged us out of the worrying sort of mire, because we had the members, but we just... we weren't business people, you know, we were just gardeners and ordinary people, and we didn't really know how to run the thing. And we had lots of high-profile people like heritage landscapers and architects and things like that. But because it was all over Australia, it was hard to sort of put together. And then when we brought the office down to Melbourne, put Jackie Comradas in there, that's the best thing we've ever done, I think, and had a paid professional secretary. And she keeps everyone in touch with everyone and keeps all the records there. And it's just bliss compared to what it was. We lived on the telephone before that. And, you know, how are we going to do this and how are we going to do that? But we all survived. And
so it was a fairly large commitment in terms of your time at the time.
Yes, it was. It really was a very large commitment because everything was handwritten. I mean, there were such things as typewriters. I happened to have one, I suppose, that was very helpful. But yes, and ringing up, you rang up, you know, at your own expense. Well, no one minds that. But if you're ringing Tim and Barrel, you know, twice a day, every day for 10 days to get something sorted out, it just ran you up a bit, and then there was fares and things, and we all paid around. Well, no one objected to that in the slightest, not in the slightest. That was something you did for something you believed in and got some enjoyment out of. But the way it's run today, I think, is just so blissfully easy. I'm sure we still have our hiccups, you know, from time to time. The conferences are always hard work. And always will be. And that's because they're popular, and it's because Tasmania's well off, really. But when you go to Melbourne and Sydney and you have to get 4 buses loaded by a certain time and out through all the red lights out of Sydney, it's lunchtime, so you really don't have very much time to do anything. And I remember years ago we discussed that we would try and avoid the two capital cities and go for the, like, Ballarat or, you know, the Barrel's very popular, of course. Goulburn we did. Tasmania's not as easy, really, but the big cities are really a nightmare.
We're sitting at Pigeon Hill, your home, Bernie, which has been on many a garden tour because we're talking about an exemplary garden. You talked about passion and, you know, doing things because you love it. But how did you get to the level of involvement in gardening that you have? What was your inspiration?
Well, I really don't know, to be perfectly honest. I live in the country and I think possibly when we were children, we came from New South Wales, and it was in the Depression, and people just didn't have gardens. They just had vegetable gardens and survival gardens. But we stayed a lot with our grandmother at Killeen, and she had a huge, rambling old garden. And I think we didn't think anything about it at the time, that a lot of that rubbed off on us, because I noticed my three sisters are all keen gardeners. And we often say, remember at Killeen, remember at Killeen, remember at Killeen. We had this or we did that, or that she had that. And it just sort of rubbed off on us. But when I came to live at Pigeon Hill, I thought I'd have a garden, of course. And my husband said to me, well, you can't have any of this level land. You can only have the gullies, because anywhere I can have a tractor, take a tractor, I need. The fact that he was an engineer and not a farmer. And I had the gullies, and I just spread my wings along the gullies willy-nilly and have continued to do so. But like everything else, everything grows in Tasmania, especially on the northwest coast, and you don't have to be very clever to have a good gardener. The thing that really interests me most of all is landscaping, and I don't think we give enough time to whether it's the TV programs or whether it's books, it's how to grow plants and how to grow this and how to grow, but not good landscaping. And the few times I've been asked to judge the Bernie garden competition, I get myself into all sorts of strife and saying, well, the flowers were good, the paths were neat, you know, everything was onky-dory, but I thought the landscaping was absolutely ghastly. And that's only my opinion. And who are you to judge? You know, what gives you the right to go into somebody else's garden and say, so you've got to be very careful and very diplomatic. And I've learnt how to be very diplomatic, get everyone on side. But yes, I think we're not taught, whoever teaches us, and we don't take on board the marriage of the house with the land. And it's all very well for me to say that, because I've got plenty of land. If it doesn't suit me, I'll just move the fence. But when you're in town and you've got neighbours, especially if they're not gardeners, it's very much more difficult. And I've got myself into all sorts of hot water by saying to people, why are you making such a fuss about the cherry blossom on the lawn? I think it looks beautiful. Oh, it makes such a mess. It comes over from next door, you know. The usual things happen in town, but I consider myself very fortunate not to have those troubles.
Now, you said that Pat gave you the call and that's how you became involved with the Garden History Society, but surely that was more than that, more than just a friend calling on you.
Well, I didn't really know Pat, or I knew who she was. I'd probably met her at functions, you know, from time to time. I just thought it'd be something a bit different, actually. I just think it was a bit different, and I am interested in history. I didn't really know that the garden history existed. And because I'm a Tasmanian, I'm aware of we've got some very lovely old homes. And I'm glad I don't live in one, because you are constrained by what the population around you. And I could name half a dozen places, and people say, oh, I would love to get, including Pat Cameron, I would love to get rid of these rotten old macrocarpa or radiata pines, you know, baking the kitchen like a black hole of Calcutta or something. But of course, they're historically interesting. Well, I think to myself, just hope they get the bore and blow down. But, you know, if if you go to do anything with them, there's always someone in the village or in this community, oh, great-great-grandfather planted those. You couldn't possibly take them out. And so you can't really do your own thing.
But you weren't probably alone in not knowing much about Garden History Society at the time you joined?
No, I don't know why we all joined. I think it was just something new, something different to the usual little garden club you belong to in your own hometown, wider scope, and the opportunity to hear some of these interesting speakers and to hear what they've got to say and to join in, and the conferences, you really do meet the most interesting people, very skilled, very knowledgeable, not only in gardening but all sorts of other skills as well. The social side of it is very enlightening, pleasant. You come home exhilarated and think, oh, better get on with the weeding.
Let's spend a little bit of time talking about your role with the National Management Committee. Did that become automatic when you became the president?
No, it doesn't automatically be the president, but it's a good idea if the president can see her way clear to going. We had two representatives, and it's very, and it doesn't have, the representative doesn't really have to be on the state committee either. She can be just from the floor. But it's very handy if you have one or two from the state committee, because they bring the news back and they can use it themselves, whereas if it's someone from the floor, they perhaps don't get round to telling you for a few weeks or something. It's very, very useful. And I found that when I was the president, I said, well, I'll go if that's okay with you, Phyllis. And I did, because you could see what the thinking was for the whole of Australia, and you could see where you could help or couldn't help or what the problems were.
And what was the thinking at the time that you joined?
About?
On the National Management Committee, the thinking, was that really about where the society was going to go in terms of the financial crisis that it had?
Yes, it was, and it was looking to the future and looking to whether we would ever be in a position to help financially people who have got a nice old garden, but it's quite beyond them, because it's mostly an engineering feat to drain it or do something expensive, and whether we would ever be in a position to do that. And the decision then, and I think this still holds good, no, we couldn't help private people, but we could concentrate on the National Trust houses, which I think we do, and we in Tasmania only do Runnymede, and possibly we did a little bit of Clarendon, but we just don't seem to have the members who can give the time to those gardens. Runnymede, being in Hobart, is quite convenient, but Clarendon and I used to go and help with. But we have always tried every year to put some money aside for something that one of the National Trust houses needed. And we re-roofed the Clarendon Gardener's Cottage, and we did Franklin House Rose Arbor, which was a huge job. I thought it was just going to be a couple of planks. And we did the historical walk. We named that in the Botanical Gardens in Hobart. I'm just trying to think of the things we did. And then we gave some to Carrington Mill to pay for a study in landscaping, whoever owned the mill at the time. So we've done that. And I think the other branches probably do the same. But you really need big lots of money to go and help someone, and they don't always want your help either. It's their home, and they don't want people coming in and telling them what to do. You have to be very careful that you don't upset people or yes.
Now, I know there's been a newsletter for a long time in Tasmania, but at the time that you were president, was that the way you were communicating to the state members?
Yes, we had good newsletters, I thought. I enjoyed writing the newsletters, actually. I did the so-called editorial, but the first two pages of what we'd been doing, what we hoped to do, and all the adventures we'd all been having. And that kept us in touch well, I thought, and it had the dates of forthcoming events and things like that. Actually, I thought that the newsletter was absolutely vital for everyone. And I enjoyed helping put that together. Then we had the national one, of course, as well. But the state one kept the members up to date with what was happening and where they were required and what they could do and what they could bring. And yes, I think that the newsletter is absolutely vital in most organisations, actually, but we found it so.
And how did you recall the National Journal when that was launched? What impact did that have, do you think?
Well, we had various. We had Tim North, and we were part of the Garden Journal, the Australian Garden Journal, and it was you could buy it on the bookshelves, you know, and we just had two or three pages at the back. Well, when we left Tim, Peter Watts very bravely said he would take on a publication. And because we had no money, I seem to be harping on that, we had about five or six pages. And Peter, being a architect and specialising in heritage buildings, it was a bit inclined that way, my personal view, not so much gardening. And he did that for a couple of years. And then really and truly, it's a big job putting out the national newsletter. I mean, because it's a historical thing, you've got to dig up all the information and make sure it's absolutely correct. Well, that's easy for Peter. It wasn't for me, I must say. And then we had Trish Dixon, who was absolute bliss, because she wrote like she talks, friendly and lovely, and she kept the historical thing there, but she came down to earth a bit and sort of spoke to us like a friend, you know, and she had interesting articles, and she also had the great plus of having an office of her own, and she'd published her own stuff, and she'd written books, and she was very au fait with the whole thing, and she did that for I think about 5 or 6 years, and it's not easy getting all the information, getting it on time, getting the photographs, and because Trish is such a good photographer too, I loved her newsletters, and then she bowed out, understandably, and we had Nina, who is, of course, very historical, and just another look at it. And she's brought a lot of historical data, like the Chinese gardens in various towns and things like that, and the history of this, that and the other. I find very interesting, and in keeping with the what we're supposed to be doing. It's very easy to get off the line and, get away from the historical side, which, if you're not careful, just makes it another garden letter, or garden report. So Nina's been good. How long she can carry on, I don't know.
Well, with the vision of hindsight, do you think the Garden History Society is doing what it set out to do?
That's a very awkward question, and I would say, at this point in time, no. I would say that we were lacking. It's very easy to fall into the trap of just being nice gardens and not really doing what we set out originally to do, was to try and preserve and encourage and preserve and encourage and maintain some of the old gardens of Australia. And I really don't think we are doing that. And for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes people don't want your help. Sometimes it's too much for us. And sometimes it's only one state, for instance. There are a lot of excuses. But to answer your question, I'd say no. And I think we just need revitalising a bit. we sort of settled a little bit into the doldrums, I feel. Whether that's because I'm got old, I don't know, but I do feel we're just a little bit in the doldrums. It's very hard to find something interesting and exciting to do and to carry everybody with you, you know. That takes a lot of effort, actually.
So you think more could be done to preserve existing gardens?
I think that we here in Tasmania would have to concentrate on the National Trust gardens, because really and truly, the people I know, I don't know that they really want us as a society in their gardens. I think they want to be field free. It's a bit like, you know, when you live in one of these lovely houses, say, oh, you can't have an iron roof. It's got to be shingles. And it's all very well for somebody else, but shingles cost a lot of money if you can get them. So they must, and I wouldn't like to be told either. I think this is my garden and I have the right to do what I like. But I can only think we just have got to plug away. And I think if we concentrated a bit on the National Trust gardens, of which we seem to have quite a few, we might be showing them the way. But in keeping the society alive and bringing over speakers or people like Peter Valder and John Broadbent and those people who are stimulating speakers, I think is a good way of keeping us, you know, going. Whether we're just wound down a bit, I don't know, to be perfectly honest.
Do you think we need the Garden History Society now as much as we did then?
Yes, I think we still need it, but I think that we've wakened a lot of people up to what it was there for, and there isn't perhaps quite the need. I think that and the environmental people, I think it's, you know, we've all had the big wake-up call. Now, don't destroy it. If you want any help, we can perhaps point you in the right direction. Not necessarily do it, but point you in the right direction, or suggest you might get in contact with certain people. But I think there is still a place for it. But I do think that from the very beginning, its main purpose achieved what it wanted, was to alert people to what they had. And if you can help it, please don't destroy it, you know, because once it's destroyed, it's destroyed for all time. So I think it was a great... as I said in the beginning, I think the people who had been struggling, some of the old houses I've been in, have been really struggling, and they say to you, what would you do, you know, what would you do? And I think, well, what would I do? the very fact that they can talk to someone else, a qualified person, you know, like a landscaper or someone who specialises in the restoration of old gardens, I think that's, I'm not saying they have to do it, but it just gives them another open door to consider. So I think it has achieved a lot. But whether we still need it, I think we'd need to go on a little bit longer, actually.
If you had to say, if there were two or three people that were really pivotal to the Garden History Society achieving what it's achieved, or at least being part of the society, could you name some of the characters or people who you think were really influential
in this state? Well, I think Pat Cameron was a great figurehead for all of us, and she was a very nice person to get on with, and you know, we all. I think the Mari Mills at Pansanga is a fantastic little girl, and she's managed to keep that garden more or less intact, and she's had her problems. And I think, yes, there are quite a lot. I think the Sue Gillam at, is one. She's gone in there as a new chum, you know, and realised what she's got and hasn't spoilt it, and has And of course, the Ranikar family, I think, are quite unique. I think the people who, like Dr. Laker, who went into Killeen, I think he led the way up in the north, really led the way in what can be done without destroying anything. And the people who are there now, the Finns, I think they're continuing very well, actually. And the Philippa Hurst out at Scottsdale, I think she has done a lot for gardening generally and the garden history. She's very involved with the National Trust, so she's sort of, you know, the two tie in together there. I think the Woolmers people have grasped the nettle there. And I haven't been to Killymoon lately, but I think the girl or woman at Killymoon, Susan Irving is another. There are quite a few about. And I must say it's very handy to have a little bit of spare cash. Of course it is, because gardening stuff, it's not the plants, it's the stone walling and the drainage and all the boring things that cost money. The plants are the easy because you can always get them from friends or save up for birthdays and things like that. But no, I think those people, they're more... Oh, the girls on the East Coast who are battling the cotton girl, Jill Cotton, and those girls down Swansea Way who are battling with this very dry conditions, really, and light soil and sea breezes and... they're battling, but they're getting there, and the battlers are the ones that you admire because, you know, they get eaten out and they get these salt winds come in and
And what about in the society? Who do you recall as being some of the colourful characters that you've come across in your time, friendships that you've made?
My personal friendships, well, actually, I've loved them all. Comes to mind Zoe McKay, who was a marvellous secretary, Jenny Prevost, Margie Stackhouse, were all great friends. Mary Darcy, I've got utmost admiration for. She's a good gardener, she's a good friend, she's got a great sense of humour. I love Mary.
And what about those amongst the committee I'm probably thinking about? On the committee?
Well, Margie and Jenny were on the committee.
As was Mary.
Yes, we didn't have anyone sort of eccentric, if that's what you're thinking of.
What about nationally on the national committee? Who were the really influential ones you think that worked on a national level?
Well, I think Althea Russell did a fantastic job. And I think Jocelyn Mitchell had a rotten job, and she did it so well. And
why was it rotten?
Because it was so difficult. She was there at the changeover thing. We had no money, and all the information went through her husband's, all the writing and notes and memo. Lord knows what it cost her. She kept the thing together. And her husband's office in Melbourne, I think, did all the work. Margaret Darling was a first-class chairman, and she too put an awful lot of personal time and effort and money into the association. And I don't think the members, quite rightly, didn't know who put in what, but there were some very generous members. Joan Lorna Smith was such a lovely person. She was just a lovely person. And Dame Elizabeth. The fun of Cork, you know. And Michael Bligh, they were all, he was a dear boy, Michael Bligh. Was not a very good treasurer. But I just can't think, I'm caught on the hop here. But they were all, they weren't the rockers of the boat, I wouldn't say. I disagreed. With one or two on certain points, but I wasn't really very keen when we went ahead and did the gave the money for the companion that went on and on and on. Richard Aiken, did that, and I said, God, what a waste of money. And when it came out, of course, it's invaluable. I have to eat humble pie there. But I know Margaret herself, you know, was backed that to the hilt.
So there was a sense of unity, a sense of focus amongst the National Committee?
Oh, yes. I think so. I think the National Committee, they changed each year, or, you know, there was always someone going or coming. No, I think they all pulled together well. They had their differences of opinion, but there was I never remember any rows or, you know, just think, well, I disagree with Tom, Dick or Harry. That's my personal opinion, and you're allowed to have it. No, there was no infighting. I didn't ever notice that, any infighting, I'm glad to say. I keep saying Althea Russell. She always impressed me as being a very sensible, hard-working, broad view of things. I was sorry when her time came and she had to go.
Now, a lot of people have talked to me about that garden tour. It lives on in collective garden history, memories, that garden tour you took of Tasmania. Can you recall what it was like, some of the funny times about that? Because it really was a landmark, wasn't it?
Well, of course, I got into a great deal of strife because we wanted the money. And Robin LaWarne said to me, do you think you could take a tour of Tasmania and earn us some money? We need two or three, I'll say 3,000. And she said, if you could raise five, it'd be marvellous. And I thought, well, anyhow, I asked all my friends and I wrote to them personally and I said to them, so-and-so, and could we see the garden? And do you think you could do lunch for $10? Which seemed to me exorbitant price at the time. And could you do morning tea for even less, you know? And some of them said, oh, yes, we won't charge you fairy at all. And we didn't pay at all. We didn't pay anything to go into the gardens. And then I was so embarrassed. I wanted to give them all a little present. I didn't want to charge the committee. So I went into the local bookshop and I bought 16 copies of The Man Who Planted Trees. And 3 years later, I went to the same shop and he said, no, some woman came in here some years ago and brought every copy in Tasmania. Rather than hire the bus, like from one of the reputable lines, I hired the school bus. Oh, I never lived this down. The school bus from Cressy, because I knew the bloke, the boy, the young man. And he did the school bus and and Anne Cripps in particular, nearly died. She said, you must be mad, Fairy. She said, be full of minty papers and cigarette butts. And I said, no, it's a new Mercedes, or, you know, fairly new Mercedes. And it's, I've had a look at it. And the thing is, Phil knows where we're going. And he knows all the people, you see. He runs the school bus and picks up all their children. So I was a little bit worried. I couldn't get him into uniform. He was, you know, relaxed dresser. And that was a bitter pill for me. I used him twice. And do you think, and I asked his father, can we get him into uniform? He said, I can't. See what you can do anyhow. He was always on time. What he'd do, bring the children into Launceston, the first one we did out of Launceston, bring them into Launceston, and then he'd be round at the hotel at 8:30. We'd all climb aboard. And we had fun. It's much better these days where you get scripts and things, but I had to do it as we went along. And I remember we went to Killeen, and I said to Phil, just drive round the block which takes in the village green and the church. And I said, and that's the church where my cousin who was on this trip was married. And I said, go round again, would you, Phil? Because I haven't quite finished the story, and how the Busbys said they were teetotalers and never drank anything, but they made so many homemade wines and liqueurs, were far more, you know, little things like that, and how the local, all the local history of Westbury, which I know quite well. So we had to go round the block about four times till I finished the story. And that was when Dr. Lake was there, and we had lunch in the garden, of course, a beautiful garden. And we went all over the place, and Sally Darling was on the trip, and she said at the end, Fairy, I don't know where you get all these girls from. She said that all blonde and beautiful, and we'd go to Esk Farm and we'd have morning tea and there'd be three there, and then they'd all rush around to Prue Greens and help her do lunch. And then they'd rush somewhere else to Michael McWilliams. That day, and when she wrote in her resume, whatever she said, and Fairy and her golden girls, who appeared at everywhere we went, so I wrote to them all and I said, don't ever change the colour of your hair. God, you're known as Fairy's golden girls. But we, I don't know, we, oh, and then, the, yes, we had fun because I did it the best I could without, I hadn't been on that many tours myself. And someone said to me, Fairy, would there be any chance, because I made the mistake of saying that Avondale and Longford were full of antique shops, would there be any chance of stopping at one? And I said, certainly not. We're due at Winton for morning tea. So, unbeknownst to me, they approached Phil and they said to Phil, could you be in here by 8 o'clock if we all got up early? Could you? And then Fairy won't lose the half hour that she's in and we'll go to the, we could just stop at one, the antique shop. So Phil said, well, I'll see what she says. So, really, Phil, I know what antique shops like. They'll get in there and we'll never get them out. So that's just what happened, I said. Everyone back on the bus in 3/4 an hour. If not, we'll just drive off because it's not fair to our hostess in a very bossy thing, you know, blah, blah, blah. So they got in there and out rushed Bruce Rosenberg and said, I've just bought a gentleman's chair. And I said, I hope you're not going to bring that on the bus. And then Nikolai Simpson rushed out and she said, Fairy, come and have a look at this bed, would you? I said, don't tell me you brought a bed. And she said, oh, yes, I think it's mahogany. I said, turn it upside down and see if there's any boars in it. And, of course, Michael McWilliams is there on his own. And he, of course, but everyone paid with traveller's checks, which takes a little bit more time. And then we had to get it from, how would we get it from Brambles? And how would we get it from Melbourne to Sydney and Sydney to Barrel or Hay or Lord knows where. And that took time. And then someone bought a 12-piece dinner set. I thought they might run in and buy an egg spoon or something. No such luck. Well, we were hours late. Oh, they were hours late. While they were waiting, Phil, who was the driver, said to me, there's another antique shop down there. Shh, don't let them hear that. So I went and had a look. And the first thing I saw was one of those Campbell flour troughs, just what I wanted. I said, don't you dare tell anyone. And I put it in the bag. Anyhow, and what was the other funny thing that happened on that trip? We did. We had an awful lot of fun because they were all... Oh, we went to Simmons Plains. Now, there's a girl. I really... She's a great gardener. A great gardener and so hospitable. And a beautiful garden. Yes. We got there and we were... how are we going? She rang up that night just as I was getting to bed and she said, that was the nicest group of people I've ever had here, Fairy. I'm just ringing to tell you. I was at school with her. She's a little girl and I was a big girl. And so I got on the bus and I said, now, Shirley... Yule has just rung, and she said, you are the nicest group that she's ever had. Now, don't let that go to your heads, you know, and all that sort of thing. And then we were sitting somewhere having morning tea, and a lady came over, and she said, Fairy, would there be any chance of going to the design centre? And I said, no, I cannot alter this schedule. And she said, well, you know, when we come back into Launceston tonight, would it be open? I said, it's a long weekend. It's Friday night. I would imagine they'd shut at 5 o'clock. And I doubt if we'd be back before 5:30 at the very earliest. And she said, I said, if you want to ring them up, she had a mobile phone, and see what they say, you do it. But I can't guarantee that you're going to be back there by 5:30. So she came over and she said, oh, the girl knows you at the design centre. I said, does she? And she said, yes, her name is Margaret. I said, oh, Margie Sadler, of course, she's at the design centre. And I said, oh, have you got her on the phone? Yeah. I said, Margie, look, I've got all these people. We won't be back till 5:30. And she said, oh, I'll stay open. I said, I know you're going home. She lives at Boat Harbour. You know, she's one of the Sadlers. You're going home tonight. And she said, oh, well, I can go in the morning. And I said, oh, Margie, you can't. She said, well, I will because, you know, it'll be good business. I said, God, I hope it is. Anyhow, into the design centre we went. And they were there till about 7:30. And what they didn't buy was nobody's business. And she rang up next day and she said, I made more money in that one and a half or 2 hours than I have in the whole week. And she said, any time, Fairy, any time you've got to come. And I said to them, this little girl, I've known her since she was a baby. She is bringing up two children on her own. I told them the story. She married the Greek, you know, etc. I told them all the story and the history, driving along on the bus. And that's what I think made the trip, all the little bits and pieces. And I said, she's absolutely beautiful, this girl. Now I expect everyone to buy something. We got on the bus with parcels. And we got out about 8 o'clock. But that's what you can do in a small place, you know. And I went to her. She's remarried. And I went to her party about 2 months ago. We had a lovely time. And what else did we do on that trip? And Phil was so obliging, you see. He wasn't tied down to, like, the Tiger Line bus, you know. It has to be back at base 6:30, understandably, and that man goes off duty and somebody else. But Phil just, you know, went along, and I said, and they acknowledged how nice that was, you know, having someone who was one of them. And of course, he was a Rotarian, and when we'd go into Esk Farming, what's the boy's name? Stuart. Oh, hi, Phil. How did the meeting go last night? You know, friendly, very like Trish Dixon's tours, and that's why I love them, because she had all these Monaro people the other day. We had a ball. Oh, that's nothing to do with that.
But you've been just about to every conference and lots of tours. Do people still talk about that tour to you?
Well, yes, they do. The ones that are on, say, and occasionally they say, "Ferry, we're getting out." I'm too old now to do those tours, and they've got more sophisticated.
And did you raise the money?
We raised $7,000. Robin LeWarn said to me, "How'd you do it?" And I said, "I paid for practically everything myself." She said, "You did." I said, "I wanted it to be a success. It's the first time done." And that, again, the last day, lunch, we came up the highway and we had lunch at Mona Vale, and we didn't have to tell Pat anything, you know. It was a lovely lunch in the garden. And she said, we walked around the garden and she said, "Would you like to have a look at the chapel?" And we went into the chapel and sat down in the pews, and she was telling us about the chapel and how her daughter had been married there. They just had a christening. And she said, "I don't suppose anybody can play." And somebody said, "They can." And they played a hymn like "Abide With Me" or something like that, but a bit more rollicking tune. We all sang it. And it was lovely. It was just a lovely finish. And she played it, and then she said, "Join in." So we all joined in. It was like, you know, "And Did Those Feet" or something like that. We had all those little extras that made it sort of funny, fun. I enjoyed it. And when we got to Michael McWilliams for the last drink, they didn't do it then, and I said to when I was doing the the expenses, I said, "I would like to on the last night at the last garden to have just a little bit of grog or something, a few savouries, to thank all the garden owners that I can get there, and to say, from our point of view, thank you for coming, and I hope you've liked it, and to thank the garden owners, you know, as a mass." So we decided to have it at Michael McWilliams, and Trina, my daughter, was working in the wine department for David. So I said, "Look, we've got no glasses, we've got no grog," and Prue Green and Joe Johnson and a few said, "Well, we'll make a few quick savouries." And we walked around that garden in the evening, February, just beautiful. And then I stood on a box and said, "Oh," and Stuart came and Prue Green's husband came, and they said, "Oh, we wouldn't miss it for worlds. We wouldn't have missed it for worlds." And it was just a fun thing. And after that, I noticed we got very sophisticated and we have proper drinks and proper champagne and proper glasses, you know. But it was like a sort of 5-day picnic or a 6-day picnic or something at the finish. Anyway, that was the best time I've had. But it was, you can get too sophisticated. I didn't have any notes or anything, you know. I just had to ad lib as I went along. Well, that's all right if you can ad lib, but when you get, you know, a little bit more difficult. Are you going to turn that off?
Yeah, I will.
Because I'm just going to tell you this funny story about when we had the Brits. I don't think this is for publication. Yeah.
Can I?
And Cripps. Some years ago, the British Garden History wrote to the Australian and said, We would like to bring our members out to have a look at the colonial gardens of more or less Eastern Australia, New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania. And Anne Cripps was doing it. And she said, would you come with me? Because I'm fairly new to this. And I said, yes. And we had them. And it was spring, rather inclement weather. And they were very nice people, very intelligent, very cluey, very interested in the convict settlements. We really had to be on top of it. And Anne had done all the spade work and all the written, you know, work. She'd done a very good job indeed. And I said to Mary Darcy, we asked if we'd go there, and I said, we're going to get to you at 3 o'clock. We have to be at the Allport Gallery at 5, and if we're late, you know, we'll never get in there again. Do you think we could have a quick cup of tea on your veranda with, you know, just the pot and perhaps scone if you're going to manage, or a sandwich? And she said, yes, certainly, Fairy. So we got there, and it was cold and misty, and she said, look, I've set it in the dining room. And she had the dining room and the sitting room with the fire and the beautiful flowers. And she had on the dining room table afternoon tea set out with 3 or 4 sorts of sugar and 3 or 4 sorts of milk and tea in teapots and coffee in pots and proper cups and saucers. And, of course, the most beautiful afternoon tea. She's a marvellous cook. And I was standing next to one British woman, and she said, oh, you colonials really live quite well, don't you? And I said, oh, do you think so? Indicating that we always had afternoon tea like that, and not in the kitchen in a mug, you know. they were very, every now and again we'd have this colonial bit, and though on the last night I must have had too much to drink or something, and I said, you know, we are really quite proud to be colonials. I'm particularly glad to be a colonial. When you think we're only 200 years old, and thinking of this afternoon tea, you know, whether she thought we'd have it in the billy or not. Oh dear, that they were. I was careful what I said there, but anyhow, I thought it was quite funny. And but that was a more staid tour. You know, they really asked all sorts of questions. You had to rush home and get out your books at night and think, gosh, I couldn't answer that. When was Port Arthur abandoned or settled or whatever it is, you know? We had a certain amount of data, but not everything. Yeah, Anne was disappointed they were going to come again last year, I think it was. Americans, weren't they? I think she was doing a tour for Americans, but crashed out at the last time. Those overseas tours, I've never done one. I think they're really hard work. Mm.
Yeah. Thank you, Fairy.
That's just